Welcome to Voices, a podcast about people. I'm your host, David E. Bowman. In this episode, I spend some time with Artie Isaac, who, among other things, teaches creativity to MBA students at The Ohio State University. Wish you could learn to be more creative? Listen as Artie shares his views on why creativity is important and how you can learn to incorporate creativity into your daily life. Hi, this is David Bowman. I'm here with Artie Isaac, marketing strategist, creativity teacher, public speaker, and founder of Young Isaac. Artie, how are you today?
I'm great, David. Thank you.
It's great to be with you. I wanted to start with a question about your work at The Ohio State University. You currently teach a course on creativity to MBA students. Why is it important for MBA students and business professionals to understand, embrace, and use the concept of creativity?
There are a variety of reasons it's important to me. It's important to me because, first and foremost, if we're not being creative in our businesses, then we're not expressing our best selves. We're not living our best lives. Creativity has mercenary value for sure, but first and foremost, I'd like to help people engage more in their work and find more fulfillment and more connection with other people and improve their personal output first and foremost. Secondly, of course, beyond what might be discarded as self-help, there is the benefit to one's own career and one's business. People need to amplify the talents of those around them. They need to find opportunities, innovate, and all that requires a skill with creativity that they might not otherwise have. Or if they have it, they may not lever it because they think that's not why they're at work. Daniel Pink, an author I know you enjoy as I do, has said that the MFA, the Master of Fine Arts, is the new MBA, the Master of Business Administration, that 10 or 15 years from now, whatever it is we think now of MBAs, we will 10 or 15 years from now think about MFAs, that those are the people we call to save the company. Those are the people that will march in and set things straight. And what he's getting at is the Master of Fine Arts is a degree of creativity where the MBA is quickly becoming a tactical degree. They're both trade school degrees, but which one will lever creativity more, and in levering creativity more, keep nations, and I think of America first, keep America ahead of other economies. It's not going to be our ability to scale business, which is what MBAs famously know how to do. It's going to be how to innovate and dream up new ideas and find new ideas in the old in front of us.
Well, further along that path, then, as an educator, if we look at the product going into the MBA programs, into colleges, going back to the K-12 system, much is made of proficiency testing now and sort of teaching the kids to pass the test. In doing so, are we, in some senses, failing our kids in the very thing we should be pushing them towards, which is how to think creatively, how to be innovative, which is where it has been a historic strength of the American economy and the American educational system. Are we making a mistake by strictly focusing on proficiency and proficiency testing?
You know, David, to me, the answer depends on how good is the test. If we're looking out, you know, my son is 11 years old, my daughter's 15. If we look at 20 years when they're really entering the peak of their careers, if we look at 40 years when they maybe are at the peak of their productivity, we have to ask ourselves, well, what are they going to be doing? Do we know what they're going to be doing? We have no idea what they're going to be doing. I don't have any idea what I'm going to be doing in 5 years, let alone what my kids will be doing in 20 or 40 years. And so we have to ask ourselves, have we written the test that will help us know whether we're educating my kids for 20 and 40 years out? Obviously, I don't think we believe that. So I am skeptical when it comes to testing to measure the success of our educational system. Problem is, we have to test. We have to figure out whether our tax monies are being spent well. Colleges want to have some sort of measure of who should be coming to which colleges. Employers want testing. But testing, to me, is relatively new. Students 100 years ago weren't, as I understand, tested. They were the consumers. They were paying for this education, and they said, I'll tell you when I'm satisfied with what I'm getting. Now we test because we are no longer in an aristocracy. Now we're a meritocracy, and we want people who test better to rise faster. It's very egalitarian, and it's also now striking back at us because we're teaching people how to take tests, and the tests we're giving them may or may not be really good indicators of their readiness and preparation for the real world. I do see glimmers of hope. My son, who's in a suburban public school, I think is getting an excellent education. There's a lot of arts and music, and I think that is going to serve him well. My daughter's in a private school. She certainly gets a lot of arts and music, and I'm grateful for that. I'm equally dismayed at the lack of arts and music in our city urban public schools system, and I think that's mirrored across the nation. I also think that our kids are getting a pretty good education in creativity from their friends and in our home. I hope to think that. We're not a perfect home by any means, but we reward creativity with applause and laughter where we're smart enough and whimsical enough to do so.
Excellent. Well, more on the topic of creativity and the personal application of creativity, I hear a lot of people, you know, tell me in the context of different conversations, well, I'm just not a creative person.
Oh, yeah.
Can anybody learn to be more creative? Is it something you're just born with, or is it something that you can foster and cultivate and become more creative?
Right, and a moment ago I spoke of MBAs who may or may not be creative, and I fell into the trap myself. I hear that from a lot of people. I'm not creative, they say. And where I spoke a moment ago incorrectly, I think they are speaking incorrectly too. We are all creative. We see examples of our creativity when we're doing maybe otherwise mundane things where we don't give ourselves credit. When we're driving cars, it's an enormously creative pastime. I hope you're not too creative on your way home today or me later because of the danger. But there are a lot of creative outlets. We just don't give them ourselves credit for those moments of creativity. I believe that everybody can learn to be creative. And your question could be interpreted, as I've heard it stated less tactfully by others, which is, can you really teach creativity? And then what they're implying is, no, you can't. And so my answer to can you teach creativity is this. Are there things I could say to you or things I could not say to you? Are there resources I could give you or resources I could deny you? Are there priorities I could place in front of you or take away from you? Is there a place I could put you or people I could surround you with, that all of which would make you less creative? Well, of course, the answer is yes. That's life. That's what life does to us. Priorities make us... they make us more responsible. They make us more, our priorities become often less creative. What I have found is if we can stop saying those things to each other, if we can stop giving each other those priorities, if we can shift the resources we give and then change the places in which we sit, then we might find a way to return to a natural creativity. We were all creative at one point in our lives. It was when we were young, and we woke up, and we were in middle childhood, and we were, I don't know, 8 years old, 10 years old. We woke up, had one thing in mind, ride the bike or climb the tree or build the fort or whatever it was, grab a sandwich and go, be home by dinner, and that was high creativity. That is, I believe, our natural state. It was the carrying of briefcases and the stringing on of neckties and all these priorities and day planners that made us not less creative, but it made that secondary. It's not unlike, you know, my students at Ohio State and elsewhere, because I teach creativity as broadly as I can to any group that'll sit still. People come to me and they say, I understand what it takes to be fit. I got to go to, you know, I got to work out. You tell me 3 times a week, 5 times a week, depends on who you're listening to. I have to do aerobics for this long and weightlifting for this long and meditation and yoga. I got to do all these things. And everyone understands that. And if you don't do those things, you know what happens. You know what it takes to be nutritionally fit. You got to eat broccoli and you can't just eat Pringles and you have to make these choices. Well, being creative is the same thing. If you're willing to spend an hour a day on your creativity, you can become the most creative person on the block. There's no question, because nobody else is doing it. And on the other hand, if you don't spend any time on your creativity ever, why would we be surprised if you find yourself not to be creative? So the assignments I give to our MBA students are ones that unfortunately take time and could be considered creative exercise, but they work. And it all comes down to, how bad do you want it? Do you want to be fit? You better go to the gym. You might need a trainer. Do you want to be creative? You gotta give me some time, right? Otherwise, why would you be surprised if all we became were robots? If all we do is worship our to-do list?
Well, one of the things you mentioned is time. Time being the ultimate scarce resource.
Oh yeah. I'm running out. I'm 48. I'm going to live to 96, which means I'm middle-aged right now at this moment.
The halfway mark. And I'm a marketer, and I did that math. So with you, you write a blog. You're involved in any number of activities, and you're pretty involved in the emerging web. Yet, like television, the internet can represent a huge, huge source of not only interruption, but just mindless entertainment. How do you manage to use the web to make you more creative and more productive as opposed to just being consumed with the thick of thin things, as they say?
Yes, I wish I were more disciplined than I am. So I can't claim to be cured when it comes to staying effective as much as I want to be. I mean, of course, we all have downtime and that's fine. A couple of things come to mind, and it may or may not be the web that I'm using, but I learned from a teacher long ago that there are 3 types of days. There are days of rest, there are signature days, and there are administrative days. The signature days, I'll start with that, are the ones in which I'm doing only those things that only I can do. So if it's public speaking in my own way, if it's writing my blog, if it's doing the things that have my personal signature on them, teaching, then marketing, consulting, those are the things that I think only I can do, at least in my own way. When I'm doing those things, I make sure I do those the entire day. I don't let any administration come into the day. Administrative days are days in which I'm cleaning my desk, I'm answering all the email, I'm writing checks, I'm running errands, I'm doing the things that have to be done to maintain the rest of the life that can free me up for signature days. And then there are days of rest. Early in one's career, one has, at best, 1 signature day a week, 5 administrative days, and 1 day of rest. As the career extends, we try to have more signature days and fewer administrative days and 1 day of rest. And then towards the tail end of someone's career, we try to have more signature days, minimize administrative days, and have more days of rest, not just one. So that's a philosophy that I try to adhere to, and I'm actually pretty good at that, though sometimes days overlap, and I really do it from sunset to sunset, some do it midnight to midnight, sort of depends on who you are. How do I use technology in order to make myself more effective? One thing I do, I found myself years ago, about 3 years ago when I started my blog site, or started knowing I needed a blog site, I found myself going to lunch on a Tuesday with David, and I would tell him a story. And then I'd be at lunch with Louise the next day, on Wednesday, and I'd tell you the same story. And Thursday, I'd be having lunch with Louie, same story. And I realized they might be interested, but I'm boring myself. And that is a bad life. And so what I started doing was writing down the stories into my blog site. And if it ever comes up at lunch, I can say, oh, you know what? Let me just send you the link. That's not the most gracious conversational tick that I have, but it helps me not to, and I'm finding that sometimes when people meet me, they've already read the story. And they say, oh, I already read that. And we can just move on. It's much faster. So that's why my blog site is named after one of my grandfather's really tiresome stories called Net Cotton Content. He told it all the time. My sisters would get up and leave the room. I stood around a few times, but I started looking for the door too. And now I store my stories there. How else, you know, I use Twitter, but not too much, you know, to let people know what the next offer is for them to get engaged with me. I don't say when I'm, you know, eating a cucumber, but I'm okay learning about when you do. It's just, I just put down, here's the next, it's almost like a little advertisement. Here's the next time I'm giving a lecture. Are you interested? Please come.
Yeah.
Where else do I use technology to help? You know, this is a really odd one. In my email system, you know how you're allowed to set up a signature with your phone number and stuff like that. I have about 40 signatures, and some of them are 4 and 5 paragraphs long. Every time I write an email, it's like Net Cotton Content, my blog site. Every time I write an email for the second time, like, here's directions to get to my house, or here are things you might want to know about me before you meet me for the first time. I mean, you know the emails that you write over and over again. I turn those into signatures. And so if I ever find myself writing the same email a second time, I make it a signature and I never write it a third time. Right? Does everyone do that?
I don't think so.
Okay.
They should. That's a great idea.
And one thing I wish I could figure out to make myself more effective, because one of the moments of low effectiveness is when I write an email and I wish I could take it back. I wish I hadn't put a typo in it. I wish I hadn't put something worse in it, like, you know, an ill-considered thought, or even worse, an offensive thought, but it's gone. A friend of mine has learned how to do this, and maybe you can teach me how. He says when he sends all his emails, it sits in a buffer for 15 minutes before it goes. And I think that is excellent. I would love to make myself slower and turn down the speed with which I respond to people, because I would become more effective in the long run. Wouldn't have to clean up so many messes.
It's funny how great an editor you become in the nanosecond that follows hitting the send button. You see about 18 typos and thoughts. Oh, I wish I wouldn't have said that.
Yeah, that happens a lot. I'm trying to think of how else I use, you know, I use a Macintosh and I love it. I have found that I can become sometimes more effective with one of my children, because we can communicate over the web, even though she's just upstairs, and we can use the video phone software, and it's fun.
Oh yeah,
you know, it's crazy but fun.
Well, one of the books that you recommend in the syllabus for the creativity class you teach is Finding Flow by Csikszentmihalyi. Talk about the relationship between creativity and flow, and you may want to just elaborate on the concept of flow, just for those who may be listening that aren't familiar with that concept.
Right. So I'll start out by saying that Professor Csikszentmihalyi, whose name we can pronounce only because he put the phonetic spelling of it on the back of his books as a kindness, because I would have never guessed. Csikszentmihalyi was the head of the psychology department at the University of Chicago when he came up with this theory. The theory of flow came about when he did a series of experiments in which he put beepers on people and sent them out into their lives with a little booklet. And when the beeper would vibrate and interrupt what they were doing at a random time, they would write down, here's what I'm doing, here's who I'm with, here's what it feels like, here's what I like about it, what I don't like about it, and a litany, an inventory of questions and answers. He took all those booklets back, lots of them, tens of thousands if I'm not mistaken, and he put them into a big machine, big computer, and out pops the meaning of life as I see it. And the meaning was that everybody has these moments of flow. It's a moment when you're doing something that you simply love doing. You're completely engaged. You are a little bit scared. You're not sure if you're going to be able to complete the task. You get immediate feedback all the time as you're doing it. In me, the hair stands up on the back of my neck. I sweat. I'm completely engaged. Time passes. I'm deaf to the world. Suddenly the sun comes up. I can't believe I'm still at it. And I realize, that was a moment of flow. Flow is known as the optimal experience. And we all have this, is what Professor Csikszentmihalyi teaches us. We all have these moments of flow. For one person, it might be gardening. For another, it might be cooking. It could be painting. If you're a doctor, it could be surgery. Wouldn't that be great if it were actually the stuff of your work? And that happens. Each of us has something we simply love to do. Most of us have found it and we know what it is. Many of us don't yet know what it is, but really, when we get to the meaning of life, it's in two parts. One is find that thing, if you don't already know what it is, and two, try to build a life around it. We often think that, well, I can't do that because if this thing I love doing is gardening, well, I can't do that all. That's a hobby. But Csikszentmihalyi says, if you love something enough to do it for free, do it more often, do it all the time, and figure out how to make money from it, because you'll be better at it than anyone else because you love it. I will note that it's not television. He has a chapter on how television is not engagement. He draws a line between pleasure and enjoyment. Pleasure is what nature has hardwired into us, this response we get when something gives us pleasure. And it's usually around food or drink or sex. It's around the things that keep the species alive. That's why so many people take drugs, because it short circuits those pleasure centers and gives them the feedback, even though they haven't actually done the thing that was supposed to give them the pleasure. Engagement and enjoyment, as Csikszentmihalyi contrasts with pleasure, those are where we're truly being creative. We're engaged. We're creating things and enjoying it. TV is pleasure, maybe. That argument could be made that it's not. It's definitely not engagement. And I think it might be none of any of these, because he says that when we look at our alpha waves, we look at our brain waves while we're watching TV, we're actually in the highest state of anxiety that we're in all day long, more than driving cars, more than going to the dentist. We are absolutely at wit's end when we're watching TV. We don't feel that way. We don't think we feel that way because we're rational. We are computers walking on body stems. We think that that's what we do to relax, and we tell ourselves that. But in the history of humanity, it's only very recently that we've been watching a light-emitting action source. And while watching a light-emitting action source, seeing so many murders, in that programming, it makes us berserk. It makes it inflicts on us and starts up that flight or fright. What is it? Fight or flight?
Yeah.
Fight or flight. It starts up fight or flight in us immediately, and we have no idea. So if you're watching TV before going to bed, you should not expect to have good sleep.
There's a visual, I believe it's in that book, that he paints of if you were to come in from an unknown planet to the world, and you could literally cut the roofs off of these homes and view what are people doing, not knowing what a television was, and you just see all these people sitting around in semicircles, catatonic, staring off into the ether, and what would your impression be? And it really was a different way of thinking about, all right, what am I doing with time as I stand here just staring off into space? Obviously, I'm entertained, experiencing pleasure in watching that, but
right.
Am I engaged? Am I doing anything?
And we're not, and there are a variety of tests we can bring to it. One would be to ask ourselves, how much TV do we think Steve Jobs at Apple watches? And how, what is must-see TV for Bill Gates? And what's Warren Buffett hoping to see tonight on NBC? And did Mother Teresa wish that she had not missed that episode of 24? there is no way. You can't convince me that's how these people are spending their time. I don't mean to say we shouldn't relax and enjoy television when we want to. I happen to choose not to do so, ever. But for those who really love TV, I would say watch any show once and enjoy it. And then maybe watch it a second time and decode it. Try to figure out, okay, what's the code? What were they doing? How are the artists who write these clever shows, what are they thinking? What do they want to happen? But if you're watching a show for the third time, you really have to ask yourself whether you have nothing better to do. And I think you do have something better to do. And this counts for sports, although I know there's a real compulsion, especially here in Columbus, Ohio, to be watching sports. But it's truly wasted time. There's you never get that time back, as you said. Doris Lessing writes in one of her books this marvelous description of how television came to England. The British would, after dinner, the men would sit in the the sitting room and argue politics and the events of the day. The women would be in the kitchen and would be shouting out corrections to what they were hearing the men misspeak. And it was beautiful. And then television came to England. And she describes it as a cloud just rolling over the countryside, putting to an end that conversation completely from edge to edge of England forever.
Wow. Well, you talked about one of the activities you don't necessarily engage in within the context of your day. Tell people a little bit about a day in the life of Vardy Isaac, who's, you know, you're a creative guy, always exploring new and challenging and different things. How's your day begin?
I wake up early without an alarm clock because at the end of the day, I go to bed pretty early because I don't watch TV and because darkness is nature's way of saying go to bed. And so I get enough sleep. There are 24 hours in a day, and my wife taught me long ago that you need 10 hours in bed to make sure you get the 8 or 9 you actually need and to do everything else you need in bed and also to get ready for bed and to get out of bed. You need 10 hours, and that leaves 14 hours. Well, she says you need 3 hours to make yourself available to this family, to be a member of this family, to know who we are and for us to know you. And that leaves 11 hours, and that's 11 hours that you can give the world and work and earn money and do all those things. She said at that time, don't ever spend a 12th hour and think it comes from nowhere. It comes either from your failing health or your failing marriage. And I always say that's what happens when you marry someone who's smarter than you are. They point out what is true. Okay, so how does the day start? The day starts, I wake up early, usually around 5, maybe as late as 6:15. And so it's whenever it is. And I get up and okay, so there are two ways to answer this. There's the way I wish I started my day, and there's the ugly way I actually do. The way I wish I could start my day, and it happens too rarely, is that I would shower and meditate. I transcendental meditation, do that for 20 minutes and enjoy simply being. That's, you know, really a great thing. And then have breakfast with my wife, and she goes off to work, and I would stay home, and I'm Mr. Breakfast. I get the kids up and out to school. The ugly reality is that I do wake up, I do take the shower, and then I immediately start typing. I feel compelled to write something down rather than trying to remember it, and I have a lot of stories in my head, so I write them down. I put them on my blog site, rdisaac.com, just about every day. The reason it's ugly, it seems functional, but I keep typing while my wife is having breakfast right next to me, and that's not good. That suddenly that doesn't count for part of the 3 hours I'm supposed to know my family. Well, anyway, so the other thing that doesn't get taken care of is exercise. And my understanding is if you don't exercise at the beginning of the day, it just is unlikely to happen unless you're more disciplined than I am.
It's too easy to bump from the list.
I'll tell you this. Joseph Heller, who wrote Catch-22, would write 2 pages in longhand before breakfast every day. That's always been his constitutional. And I heard him interviewed on, I think, Fresh Air with Terry Gross on National Public Radio. And she said, well, what do you mean 2 pages? And he said, I know what you're asking. He said, it's a legal pad. The margins are generous. I double space. Maybe I triple space. Sometimes if I don't like the way a sentence looks, I'll just cross it out and write it over. But I finish 2 pages and then I have my breakfast. And he says, so I may not get more than 2 sentences. I may get 2 full pages, but I may not get more than 2 sentences. But I'll tell you, every day by breakfast, I have 2 sentences written by Joseph Heller. And I know a lot of writers who will go to bed tonight not having written 1 word. So at least I got something down on paper. And I think that is the philosophy of becoming creative, actually doing something.
With that, with creativity, who inspires you? Or what inspires you?
You know, there's inspiration in everything. That's the fun of it. There's no lack of inspiration as long as we're willing to stop every once in a while and look around. So Roger Torrey Peterson, the great naturalist from Jamesville, New York, the Jacques Cousteau, but of the dry earth, would go out into the woods or into the backyard and just stand and look around him and find what's going on, count the bugs, look at the grasses, see what's going on. He says, if you want to know nature, you don't have to go to the Amazon. You can just go outside and catalog what's around you for the, you know, 3 feet in all directions if you want. I feel the same way about creativity. if you go to the grocery store, you can just buy baking soda if that's all you need, but you can look at the other people. You can talk to the butcher. You can find out what's creative about this place and enjoy it. You know, creativity is everywhere. And I sort of think that we feel very passively about it. Because television has been served up to us and we're a generation raised on television, we sort of wait for moments of creativity to find us. They're out there. They're absolutely everywhere. So who inspires me? You know, the artists in the local museum inspire me. Mozart and Bob Marley and everyone in between inspire me. I often think of Julian Steinchek, an artist who, at the age of 13, in his native Poland, during the end of World War II, he was beaten so savagely by the retreating Russian army that he lost use of his dominant hand, his dominant arm. It still hangs at his side. He has responded by creating a huge catalog of work in which he, among other techniques, puts very thin strips of tape down on canvas, big strips, with his usable hand and one of his feet, smooths it down in lines, paints over it, then picks up the tape, so you have stripes, and then puts down another set of tape and paints over that, and you end up with sort of optical illusion, very disorienting visual art, really, really interesting stuff. He inspires me because of what he told me. I met him at a cocktail party. You can see his work online and at museums all around the world, but he was in Columbus, and he said, "What do you do?" And at the time, I was teaching art students at the Columbus College of Art and Design. I told him I was doing that. He said, "Do you know why artists go into the studio?" I said, "No, why is that?" He said, "Well, artists go into the studio filled with fear." He described flow. He said they go in filled with the fear that they might not be able to do it again. And so they go into the studio to prove that yesterday was not a fluke, to create some sort of tangible record that, yes, I did it again, to create some sort of fossil or bone or relic or token, some sort of physical manifestation that says, look, today's Tuesday, I did it again. I did just like I was able to on Monday. I find that very inspiring because I think the most inspirational people are the ones who stare at their fear and address it rather than sitting down and self-medicating. They address it. And so I'll just add that we just described my kids. My kids are the most inspiring people. My wife is the most inspiring because she went back to school at midlife and became a nurse out of the blue, became a nurse practitioner. I find that really interesting because she refuses to compromise at any age. And our kids, you know, willingness to discover what they are as they go is, to me, constantly interesting and inspiring.
It's with children, it's amazing in that they remind you of that sense of curiosity. And they haven't figured it all out yet, and you come to realize that neither of you.
Right, oh, absolutely.
But it mirrors, you look back into your past and you say, gosh, I can remember when I was that curious about bugs and the grass.
Right.
In a different book by Csikszentmihalyi, he says, hey, a great way to learn to be creative is learn to be surprised every day. Write down one thing that surprises you every day.
Yeah.
And not only that, surprise someone every day with something that you do and write that down. And I thought, wow, what a great concept.
Yes, it's beautiful.
What about from an activity perspective?
You know, I'm sorry. So that suggests that at dinner, at our dinner, we have a tradition. We go around the table from youngest to oldest, starting with the youngest female guest. Just I don't know why. And we ask everybody, what was the best part of your day? And you can go to the night before that moment. And you can't pick the moment we're enjoying right now, of course. What is it? But I know somebody, and you've suggested this perhaps in that that search for a surprise. I know somebody who would go to bed, he would put his kids to bed, he would ask them three questions. What was the best part of your day? What was the most challenging part of your day? And what surprised you? Right? Which is great. You know?
Yeah.
So anyway, I'm sorry. Go ahead.
No, I was going to ask more from a daily activity. What's the ideal creative activity for you? Or is there one?
Well, there's probably those that I've not discovered, and I'm very eager to start taking courses in a variety of different disciplines. I used to work with a teacher of mine named Alan Bumpus, a creative director, and he said that he was, and is today, a student of more than 1,000 things. He said, I could show you a list, if I bothered to keep it, I could show you a list of 1,000 things I've actively studied, taken a course, read a book on, tried my own hand at. I find that to be really interesting in trying to figure out, well, what is the most creative pursuit for any one person? I don't think any of us knows. I like writing. I especially like writing comedy. I especially like writing funny presentations that I can give to earnest audiences, groups of people that haven't laughed for a while and really need it. I like that, and I find that I can become completely absorbed in that. The writing of my blog site is certainly the same way. Giving presentations, public speaking, those things bring me enormous flow and are, it's where I'm at my most creative. Lately, I've been trying acting, and I'm trying to make that something that I could do that would bring me the same sense of creativity. I would also say riding a bicycle is really interesting. I can't work when I'm riding a bicycle because I have to stay upright and out of the way of traffic and not going over the bumps and things like that. And but it unleashes in me just a very fluid, natural thinking.
It forces you to be in the present.
Absolutely. There is nothing but the present on two wheels. And so, yeah, I think there's something in that for me there. I'd like to say it was walking in the woods, but I haven't learned how to do that without getting bored or impatient.
One of the things in reading through your biography and looking at some of the things you discuss, both on your blog as well as in other places, is your involvement in nonprofit organizations. I think that's a great thing. I think it's really important that people give back. But I was curious as to why do you make that choice? If time is truly a scarce resource and we only have so much of it, there's only so many things you can do. You have these interests in, you know, I want to learn how to act. I want to learn how to do all these different things. Why would you choose to take that resource and give it to other people? Why would you get involved with a nonprofit and give time?
Well, I've come to realize that too many of us believe that our purpose for existing is to achieve our own comfort. And I live a very comfortable life, and I'm extremely lucky in the scope of humanity. Few have lived as comfortably as we do, not just in my house. I mean, my house is not extraordinary by any measure of my peers, far from it. But if you look at the history of humanity, this is an exceptionally comfortable life. But the way it started was I was being asked to do something. Actually, what first happens, the first time I was asked to serve on a board, a call came into the agency, and my father was working for me at the time. He'd retired, and he was working at Young Isaac, and a call came in from a big cheese in the community asking for Artie Isaac. Well, we both had the same name, and so the call was given to him, and it was transferred to me. He said, no, this fellow wants to speak to you. And he invited me to serve on a board. That's how it happened the first time. The next thing that I recall is I was being asked to serve yet again on another board by another big muckety-muck, and somebody else came up to him, one of his peers, and said, why are you asking Artie to do this? And the fellow, his name was Mel Schottenstein, a great mentor to many of us in my generation, he said, you know, Artie knows that he'll be asked to do things and what goes around comes around. And if the good he does someone now, you know, it'll come back to him and he'll be doubly repaid. I've never asked for more of a test than that. I enjoy serving on boards. I think it's an honor. Sometimes I've done better on some boards than on others. To me, it's been like golf, I think, is for some people. You play golf so you can meet people, so you can spend some time with them, you can concentrate on a subject. Well, this is my golf. I will concentrate on the art of helping a not-for-profit entrepreneur figure out what to do next. I think that's fun. And you can do it with other people, and you can see how they think. And you don't have to wear loud pants, and it doesn't take all day, and we don't drink as much. But other than that, it's every bit as fun.
Well, you're a person with options in terms of what to do, where to live, where to do what you want to do. How does someone with Ivy League education and you know, countless options in terms of what you could do with your life, how do you choose to live in Columbus, Ohio, in Ohio in general? Why would you choose that? And what makes this a remarkable place in which to live?
You know, somehow I think if we were in another place, and insert here the name of the place that needs no justification, you wouldn't be asking me this question, right? If we were in, I don't know, Paris or Jerusalem or London or Rio de Janeiro, you'd be saying, well, of course we're here. This is the center, Prague. This is the center of the universe. But here we are in central Ohio, and so the question has to be raised.
Well, I think, and part of it is I think people in, not just in Columbus, and I live near Dayton, Ohio, but I think there is a sort of inferiority complex. And I think people don't necessarily realize that what a wonderful place, and there are so
Absolutely.
Many things here.
Yeah, we're in a an area of the world, one of the few, where you could grow anything. The climate here and the soil here is such that you could grow just about anything in the world. But that's not why I'm here. I'm here initially because we wanted to have kids here. I was living in New York. I actually grew up in Columbus, Ohio. And then I moved away to New York in the East Coast for college, came back after 12 years of that at the age of 30. And we wanted to have kids here. And the theory was it's flat. We'll be able to see them, you know, and call them home for dinner because, you know, you can't get too far away in Columbus, Ohio. And I think that's true. And my daughter at one point when she was younger complained that the biggest crime she would ever would see would be littering. And what a shame that was. And I said, you know, I think that's my job as a parent is to try to make that possible. I like Columbus and central Ohio and Ohio generally for a variety of reasons. I like it because I believe that we're invited to participate. That you can participate in just about anything. You want to be on a board, you want to help a certain initiative, you want to get involved in the theater or sports or education or human service, there's a spot for you. When I lived in New York, that may have been true, but it never felt that way. I was once a bartender in Charleston, South Carolina, and my experience in Charleston was you had to sort of be one of the families. You had to be from there. Columbus, we're not that discerning. You move to town, you want to get busy? Come on, let's go. We could use your help. And I like that about Columbus. I also think there's a tradition of creativity here that appeals to me. George Bellows, the great American painter, painted here. James Thurber, certainly from this place, came through Ohio State and went on to fame and fortune at the New Yorker. I believe, from my experience living in New York and my experience living twice now in Columbus, is that New York and LA are amplifiers. They amplify trends, but they don't necessarily create them. I think they come out here to find what's weird about the world, and then they take them back to New York and LA and amplify that. I prefer to be in the fields where the weird ideas might be grown. And I think it's easier to grow ideas out here because it's just an easier life. This is the easiest life, I really think. What are we? We're 200 miles away from 25% of the world's fresh water. You know, the big war that's coming, God forbid, but the big war that's coming is going to be over water eventually. And we have it. And that's why life is so easy here. And that is, I think, also why there's so little meaning in so many people's lives, is when life is easy, it becomes somewhat meaningless. I think it's sort of fun to live in a place where life is easy and then spend most of my time trying to find meaning in what I do. So Columbus is, as a marketer, I'm practicing the craft of temptation in the Garden of Eden. And you know how well that went. You know how well that went the first time. So.
How about them apples? What advice, in terms of a closing note, what advice could you leave people as they look to improve their personal and professional lives?
Well, I guess I would fall back on a teacher of mine, Thich Nhat Hanh, a Buddhist monk, an exile from Vietnam. He left as a Vietnamese national. He left because he was against the war at the time and was driven out of the country. And what he would teach us is to simply find moments of rest and contemplation throughout the day. And the way he puts it is to simply breathe, to figure out a way to relax and to take a deep breath and to experience that there really is no past. The past simply is or was. There is no future. It's coming, but it ain't here. And until it's here, it's really not terribly important. There is only right now. The Professor Gilbert from Harvard, who studies and writes on happiness, he wrote the great book Stumbling on Happiness, says the same thing, that much of our happiness is the result of not looking too far forward, not deferring our happiness. Don't defer it. Be happy now, with some sense of responsibility for the future. So this poem from Thich Nhat Hanh is my favorite thought for closing, and it is, it goes like this. It doesn't rhyme, I'm sorry, but it goes like this. Breathing in, I relax my body. Breathing out, I smile. Dwelling in the present moment, this is a wonderful moment. And so the idea is that, and anybody can play the home version of this game, it's best played while driving. Breathing in, I relax my body, and you can do it. If you're listening to this podcast, you can do it right now. Breathing out, I smile. And it's one of those phony baloney smiles, but your body doesn't know if you're really happy or if what's gone wrong, but it works anyway. Dwelling in the present moment means that I recognize that really I only live at this present moment now. That's all that really matters. And this is a wonderful moment says, hey, so this is a good one. Why not? I find that those words, when recited while driving, improves one's driving immediately.
Excellent. Well, I thank you very much for sharing your time today and sharing your thoughts as well.
Thank you, David. I love what you're doing. I appreciate being a part of it. Thank you.